Good afternoon and welcome to the LaRouche Show. It's Saturday, August 26th, 2006. I'm Harley Schlanger and I'll be your host today. We are now 11 days away from the next international webcast by Lyndon LaRouche, which will be on Wednesday, September 6th, and it will be from Berlin starting at 10 a.m. Eastern Time. And we'll be talking some about what Mr. LaRouche will be doing with the webcast, as he has become a central figure in the battle to pull the world out of an orbit that's leading to World War III, which could include a use of nuclear weapons. And he's also central in the fight to reverse the blowout of the financial system, which, if not stopped, will lead us to a new dark age. As we're coming to you today, there is a fragile ceasefire in Lebanon. However, Dick Cheney, acting on behalf of a grouping of syndicate bankers, is still bent on an expanded war. He does want a war with Iran. Thus far, he's been frustrated in this effort. Going back to August 2005, Mr. LaRouche has consistently given advance warnings of the efforts by Cheney and his grouping in order to preempt their various operations, such as terrorism at the World Cup soccer games. These kinds of activities, such as the terrorism there or the so-called discovery of weapons of mass destruction in Syria, could have served as a pretext for a U.S. strike against Iran. More recently, in the wake of the failed Israeli attack on southern Lebanon, President Bush has been displaying increasing evidence that he's unable to handle the oncoming strategic and economic crises. Even Republicans, such as former Congressman Scarborough, are asking the question, is Bush an idiot? And one-time Bush loyalist Tony Blair is even jumping ship. So in this context, leaders in many nations, particularly in Eurasia, for example, in Russia, but also in the U.S. Congress, are looking to Lyndon LaRouche for solutions and are anxiously awaiting what he's going to say on September 6th. Something which is definitely on his agenda is overturning the incompetent and outright fraudulent approach of virtually every economist and institution to economic forecasting. LaRouche himself has a unique record among economists. He's been an accurate forecaster for more than four decades. In an effort to upgrade the work of his associates, especially members of the LaRouche Youth Movement, he has increased the pace of his work on economic animations in recent months. And his most recent published work, entitled What is an Economic System? Dynamics and Economy, appears in the August 25th issue of the Executive Intelligence Review. On today's show, we'll be speaking with Bruce Director, who's a collaborator with Mr. LaRouche on this economic animations project. Bruce is the author of the acclaimed series Riemann for Anti-Dummies, in which he's been exploring the implications of LaRouche's scientific method in physical economy. Also with us today will be two members of the special pioneering LaRouche Youth Movement Task Force working on animations, Jason Ross and Will Madursky. So let's start with Bruce. Bruce, welcome to the LaRouche Show.
Good to be here.
Well, let's begin with a straightforward question, which probably, I don't think I'm going out on a limb in saying this, could not be answered competently by most people today who have the title economist. What is Riemannian physical economy?
Well, Lynn has discussed this and outlined what he means. And it is, first of all, you have to really understand that, you have to say something which most people today really don't understand, which is, what are you talking about when you're talking about economics? The problem with the way most people think about economics today is that they either think of it having to do with something with monetary values, with the flows and exchange of money. Or they, and not just or, but also, they often think about it as sort of a type of animal ecology. They think of the, when you're looking at an economy, you're looking at an economy the way you would look at the way an animal species reacts to its habitat. And they excise from the economy the only thing that's really important about an economy, which is the way that you're dealing with human beings. And what you're dealing with in an economy is the interaction of the human mind with the physical universe as it does that through by interacting with other human minds. So in order to really understand anything about economics, you have to look at this relationship, that is the way the creative powers of the human mind have a role in changing the physical conditions of the universe by changing the way human beings interact with each other intellectually. And the characteristic of this interaction is best described, at least in first approximation, by the kind of physics and mathematics that was developed by Riemann in the middle of the 19th century.
Well, Bruce, the argument that you would get from an economist, say, at University of California, Berkeley, or MIT, is that they are applying scientific criteria, and they'll pull out a whole sheaf of papers with equations and formulas that they say demonstrate the way an economy functions, and this is the basis of their forecasting. How is that different from the mathematics that you're talking about of the Riemannian sort?
Well, this gets to the point that the youth group here is working on as the first project of the economics animations, which is to do a competent animation, a series of animations, which illustrate Kepler's discovery of universal gravitation. Because this really gets at the point of what real economics is versus what you're getting from the nutcases you described at MIT and Berkeley and so forth. The basic issue is the same one that Kepler ran up against in his refutation of the methods of the leading ideas of astronomy of his day, which was the approaches of Ptolemy, Copernicus, and Tycho Brahe, which had different approaches to astronomy, but they all contained a common flaw, which is they had adhered to the Aristotelian idea that there was no way that man could actually know anything about what caused the planets to move. And therefore, the only thing that man was capable of doing was describing not just what you see, but describing what you think you would be able to see were you able to actually see the planets moving around the sun in some quote-unquote objective way. And so they resorted to basically what today we would call statistical methods. That is, you take the basic observations of the planets, which are an angle of inclination and an angle of above the horizon and a time, and you take these various observations and you try and fit them as raw data into some mathematical scheme which attempts to explain the configuration of the data with respect to some existing mathematical structure. And this is what Ptolemy, Copernicus, and Tycho Brahe did. Now, the point that Kepler made was that the problem is that you can't tell what's true from this. And as a result, and of course, Ptolemy, Copernicus, and Tycho Brahe and their followers would not have any objection to that, because they would say, we're not really trying to determine the truth. We're just trying to describe what you see as the effect of some mathematical equation. And this is the problem you get with economics. They take basically a whole lot of statistical data, and you can see this right now, where you'll get economists who will use exactly the same statistical data to explain to argue that the economy is improving when you look at the physical conditions of life for 80% or more of the world's population. Things are getting worse.
A perfect example of that is something like GDP, where when you add in the gains from speculation, the housing bubble, those kinds of things, the spending on casinos and prostitution and drugs and everything else, when you add all that together, someone could say, well, gee, the economy appears to be growing.
That's true. And even more to the point is an example that LaRouche has pointed to, which is with respect to globalization. People argue that when you take a factory out of an advanced country like the United States with a certain a level of infrastructure and technological development, and you ship that factory to some underdeveloped country, that this is that you get the same economic effect from the factory in both places. And they point to the fact that, well, you know, you increase the living standards of the employees of the factory in this underdeveloped country, and you provide a better standard of living for the few people who work in that. But when you actually look at it from the standpoint of the physical economy, that kind of thing actually reduces the economic capacity in both the United States and the underdeveloped country. That is, what's necessary is, but from a statistical analysis, you can't tell that. But you can look at, if you look at the reality, you see, you look at what does it take to, say, take a country like China, which has still 800 million people in desperate poverty, or India, which, despite all the call centers and software development and so forth, which is going on there, that's a tiny, tiny percent of the population. And yet still you have a very huge population of impoverished people that, without an investment in a massive infrastructure development project in these countries, you're not going to be able to sustain the kind of real physical economic growth which is necessary. So from statistical methods, one could argue, or one does, these economists make a stupid argument that this gives you the same better economic effect, because you're able to produce the goods cheaper with cheap labor, and then you can make those cheap goods available to consumers in the United States. Of course, the consumers in the United States don't have any jobs, and they don't have any money, so they've been buy the cheap goods based on increasing values on their real estate and extensions of credit on their credit cards and so on and so forth. So that's basically another example of it. So what you have to look at here is, forget this idea of globalization, forget these ideas of statistical analysis of the economy, and what we have to look at is what real economics is, which is the way the human mind actually transforms man's relationship to nature, by the way it transforms man's relationship in society as a whole, not only for our existing time, but with an eye towards creating a potential for an increased capacity for future generations.
Well, speaking of incompetence in high places, we had Ben Bernanke, the Federal Reserve Chairman, give a speech yesterday, I believe it was, in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, at the Fed's annual conference.
That's a low place.
Yes, in which he presented the argument for globalization. And in the process, he said a couple things that were true. He identified the Roman Empire as a globalized system. He spoke about the importance of the British and Dutch East India Company as examples of free trade systems. He also identified the effects of Abraham Lincoln's policies at transforming the United States as an industrial economy after the Civil War. But then he came to the conclusion, which is that in spite of all the problems with globalization, it's the only policy, and we have to watch for an upsurge of protectionist rhetoric, particularly in the United States. I presume you would lump Bernanke with the incompetence that you're discussing.
Well, yeah, this is the obvious example of it. The point is that he's not going anywhere. Neither is what he advocates going to work. The thing that people have to realize is we're either going one of two ways. Either you're not going to have a globalized society in the sense that these guys attempt to envision one. What you're going to have is a collapse of living standards and a collapse of civilization, which would lead to a rapid depopulation of the planet and a dark age lasting for generations, or this whole thing is going to be dumped. So when you hear someone like Bernanke speaking, it's sort of like listening to a dinosaur talk about the future for dinosaur eggs.
You're listening to Bruce Director on the LaRouche Show. It's August 26, 2006. If you want to send an email question to Bruce, you can do that, and he'll be happy to answer your question. You can send that to us at radio@larouchepub.com. That's radio@larouchepub.com. You can also go to larouchepub.com to see Lyndon LaRouche's most recent published article. I guess it's now no longer his most recent, but his article, Dynamics and Economy. And that brings me to my next question for you, Bruce. In talking about the importance of Kepler and applying physical terms to economics, Mr. LaRouche has been discussing increasingly this idea of dynamics. So let's go back to Kepler and this question of the orbit, determination of an orbit and universal gravitation. How does that then, how do you translate that into economic analysis?
Well, the term dynamic comes from the Greek word dunamis, which was best described in Plato's dialogue, The Theaetetus, although it was a common term in Greek science, which is roughly translated into English as power. And that's where the Greek word dynamic comes from. And what the Greeks meant by dynamics was looking at not what you see in the visible world, because the objects that you see in the visible world are really the shadows of an underlying process which exists in the world, which are not objects of the sense, but are objects that the human mind, uniquely among living creatures, can recognize. And the mind has this capacity. When you take this question of Kepler, you see that we see the planets moving about the night sky, and we can reason the actual arrangements of those planets as a result of the motion of the Earth around the sun and the planets also around the sun in various configurations. But there's something else we can recognize about this, which Kepler demonstrated, which is that we can understand the cause, the principle, but is causing the planets to move in the way they move, and we can describe and understand the characteristics of those, that principle, which Kepler called gravitation, universal gravitation. So the principle of gravitation is not something which exists in the visible world. It's not something which you can see. It exists everywhere, however, in the universe, and it produces a real effect. Now, from the standpoint of economics, this is what you have to look at. The real source of wealth in an economy is not physical goods. It's not raw materials. It's not anything of that sort, although those things are obviously crucial to it. But the real source of wealth, the ultimate source of wealth, when you look at an economy, are ideas, are the creative powers of individual human beings who work together to apply the discoveries of universal principles, which produces a real material effect. As LaRouche has pointed out, when you look at the human population, you see a tend towards progress, despite the fact that for most of human society, most of human history, most cultures have been pretty bad and most people have lived in pretty oppressed conditions. The fact of the matter is that the overall trend has been towards progress, because man has a characteristic relationship to the universe itself, which is to transform the way we interrelate to the universe. And that's expressed by, you know, just in the growth of human population from where we can sustain a population now of 6 billion people and probably 10 times that, and also begin to populate the moon and Mars and other planets in the solar system.
But the generating point then of creating new wealth and increasing productivity is the discovery of new universal physical principles?
That's the only way it comes about. That's what defines what a resource is, what defines what technology is. And it defines also the social relationships of man. And this is what's unique about the development of the United States, because this country was founded as a social means of social organization to basically based on that principle that man has to organize his social relations, has to organize his political and governments from the standpoint of being able to facilitate the greatest possible increase in the creative powers of the human mind and the ability to apply those powers through society to be able to produce more ideas. So I guess in sum you could say that the major input in an economy are ideas, and the major output of an economy is ideas. And in between, you have a huge increase in material wealth.
And from the discovery of universal physical principles, is that the basis for making an economic forecast by being able to look at where you are and where you have to go? Is that what LaRouche means by an economic orbit?
Well, by when you look at the economy, you see that there are certain cycles in an economy, largely related to generational changes. But also, when you look at large-scale development projects, infrastructure projects, and so forth, you see these things have lifespans of 25, 30, 50 years. And so what you always have to be looking at when you're looking at economic development is, what are you doing today from the standpoint of what that will produce as a level of economic potential 50 years into the future? So, for example, today, if we're not thinking about how do we organize the global economy as a collaborative effort among sovereign nation states to create the capacity for human habitation on Mars, then we're not really thinking in approximately over the next 5 decades, which would be a period of time in which you will see 2 generations come to adulthood. If we're not looking at it from that standpoint, then we're not thinking about how to organize our economy in the present time in any effective way.
Well, let me bring in one the LaRouche Youth Movement panelists who've been working with you, Bruce, and working with Lyndon LaRouche in Leesburg on a special project related to the development of animations. First, Jason Ross, welcome to the show.
Hey, Harley.
So what have you been doing down in the basement the last couple of weeks?
Well, we've been given the assignment of animating creativity. So we've been working through the new astronomy in particular with the idea of animating what's crucial to Kepler's method in that.
The new astronomy being Kepler's study, Kepler's work.
Yeah, this is the development of universal gravitation, something that's often described as a formula, but almost nobody has actually gone through this work to understand Kepler's conception of it. So this
and what have you discovered from working through it?
Well, discovered that the incredible importance of actually having the new astronomy as part of what we're working on as a youth movement, because it's easy. Well, there's a certain ability to understand through things like CUSA or like the Gauss paper that we've been working on the concept of what an idea is, but to get the real beginning of modern physical science, it's essential to go to Kepler, since this is the beginning of modern physical science. What I mean by that is that, take astronomy. All of the observations that you make are geometrical. You measure an angle in the sky. You have an idea against the sphere of the fixed stars of where a planet is seen. All of the models before Kepler were geometric models. They involve circles, moving on circles with planets on these circles to create a geometric effect of a position of a planet. So Kepler's breakthrough was in taking this geometric approach and taking it as far as it could possibly go, taking sort of improving on what everybody had already done from the geometric standpoint and showing how of necessity that approach couldn't work for understanding the planets. And he did that by a crucial experiment of showing an actual observable error with this approach. So with that impossibility of taking a geometric approach to the planets, Kepler develops a physical hypothesis of gravitation, which is something that, in reading Copernicus, you saw how the idea of anything moving in a non-uniform circle struck Kepler's predecessors as impossible. Because for something that's moving in a circle to move at a non-uniform rate would require some sort of cause. But if you have only geometry, you don't have any causes. Mm-hmm. So that would be a total paradox to them.
Jason, here's something that I find part of the intriguing process of discovering what Kepler was working on. How did he figure out it was that the Earth was revolving around the Sun in a non-uniform rate?
Well, he did that by he had a revolutionary way of looking at the Earth, which was that, well, imagine this. You've got if you're trying to understand how something's moving, it's much easier. If you want to understand the position of something, if you're able to move around it, look at it from different positions, it's very helpful. The thing with the Earth moving is that since we're on it, it makes it very hard to see how the Earth moves. So what Kepler used was knowing how long it took Mars to return to its original position on its orbit, which is about 687 days. He took a series of observations from Mars of the Earth. By looking at Mars from the Earth every 687 days, basically giving him two stationary points, the Sun and Mars, to watch the Earth from. And then, using that, he was able to determine the shape of the Earth's orbit. I mean, he really noticed the non-circular shape of a planet's orbit with Mars.
Well, there is an anomaly there, isn't there?
Yeah, I mean, one thing that came up with the study of the Earth was with the study of Mars was from this impossibility of the geometric description, he then had the trouble of trying to fit his physical hypothesis of gravitation and then be able to come back to geometry with it, to try to take his physical idea and then implement it, which this ended up with the troubles that he ran into, which were the Kepler problem and prompting of Leibniz's development of the calculus.
Now, when you're looking at something like the Kepler work, and Lin has insisted on this idea of universal gravitation, how does that lend itself to the process of animations? What is an animation, first of all?
Well, one thing it's lending itself to is that in trying to get across Kepler's discovery, we're finding that a large part of that is going to be animating what didn't work. Because it's very hard to answer a question that somebody asks that they're not competent to ask yet. So for someone to ask, for example, what is a universal physical principle, being able to just give the answer might not work. You're going to be required to go through a prompting in their mind.
You have to make your own discovery.
Well, you're going to have to go through prompting in their mind the necessity for a different kind of question of what could exist as a mental object that would qualify as a physical principle. So, for example, if we're taking this with economics, you could take the... look at economic data, economic indicators. None of the things that you would measure about an economy are the economy. Money, even the amount of like food or machine tools made, none of those things actually are the fundamental process of human economics that are underlying those things. So I imagine that if we were to adopt Kepler's approach to the economics work, it would be to, in a certain way, animate the necessity of failures of alternate approaches to open up in someone's mind the question themselves that you're then able to answer about what is a true economic principle.
And are you getting to that point? Have you had some, I guess you would call them failures in the animations?
Well, we've definitely had our fair share of failures in the animations, but we haven't, I don't know, the team here in Leesburg hasn't gone, we haven't really been doing much with the economic data per se. We're focused on the new astronomy for now.
And what have you produced so far?
A number of people can there is a preliminary version of the animations on the Youth Movement website at WLYM/JROSS, so people can go see them for themselves. But we've animated the failure of the geometric statistical approach of Kepler's, and then we should have in the next day something on the implementation through geometry of his physical discovery of gravitation. So we're working on that right now.
All right, so people should keep an eye on that. We'll give that website out again later in the show. We're going to take a short break now, and we'll come back with Will Modersky, Jason Ross, and Bruce Director to discuss this question of animating an economy, animating creativity. This is the LaRouche Show. It's live every Wednesday from 3 p.m. to 4 p.m. Eastern Time. And if you're listening from the United States, you can get us on or actually anywhere in the world, on the LaRouchePub.com website. And if you miss it live, it is archived, so you can pick up the LaRouche Show. There's an archive of all the shows going back a couple of years. And in fact, Bruce has been on several times. You can go back and listen to the progression by going back to past shows, the progression of the work that's been done by Bruce and Lyndon LaRouche and others on this question of physical economy. If you're interested in material, for example, the Executive Intelligence Review, you can give us a call or the recent material put out by LaRouche PAC on combating Bush and Cheney and the insanity of the administration. Call us at 800-929-7566. That's the LaRouche PAC website, and you can get the literature from what Lyndon LaRouche has been writing. So we're back with Bruce Director. Bruce, you just heard what Jason has been discussing. I know you and I have discussed this question quite a bit over recent years. The difficulty for people to comprehend something when they are looking to try and see it first, and you talked earlier about the shadows, we're really talking about an approach to not just economics, but to what is human knowledge, aren't we?
Well, yeah, we're talking about what really is the nature of man, and unfortunately most human beings don't really have a understanding of what it means to be human. That's one of the things that people really have to become conscious of, how the popular opinion, the prevailing view of what is a human being is heavily influenced by the empiricism and materialist and all kinds of crazy ideas that people have, which really ignore and deny what man's fundamental characteristic is, which is this unique power of cognition, which is not just something that exists in human beings, but it's something that exists in human beings for the development of the universe itself. And when you look at the relationship of any individual human being to society and to the universe as a whole, you see that man is not just an add-on to the universe, but is essential to the development of the universe itself. Now, Lynn, of course, has raised something that's going to be very important for people to be able to actually understand this, which is to get a real understanding of what today modern science would call as a Riemannian tensor, which is an idea which originates out of the work by Riemann in his 1854 habilitation dissertation. He didn't give it that name. That name was later applied to it in the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century. Einstein made it more popular. But this is the there's a lot of mathematical formulations out there about what a tensor is, but it's really a question of looking at or the way in which the mind actually recognizes not just a single universal principle, but a whole interaction of universal principles acting together to produce an effect.
And you take this up in your most recent pedagogical.
That's correct, which should be out soon.
Okay. I want to come back to this because I know this is probably going to be increasingly important in the discussion that Lyndon LaRouche will be leading both in Berlin and in a lot of seminars on this question of forecasting. But I want to bring in our other panelist, Will Madursky. And actually, before I bring in Will, I just want to get out an idea, Bruce, that was implicit in what you just said, which is that while this work of Kepler, Leibniz and others represents the outgrowth of the development of human civilization, there's been an effort to suppress and destroy that method, hasn't there?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this goes back not only to Kepler, but then followed up in the famous falsified dispute between Newton and Leibniz over the calculus, and the later attempts by Cauchy and then the most recent modern versions of Bertrand Russell and von Neumann and Wiener and so forth to substitute for real science and real scientific discovery mathematical formalism.
I was talking with someone the other day who said, why does LaRouche keep going back to Russell why does he think you have to make an enemy out of Isaac Newton? How important is it to actually get this real history out there?
Well, it's important for people to really understand how they've been brainwashed. The problem is that what dominates popular opinion today and what pretty much dominates the education in not only universities but also secondary schools and elementary schools in math and science but other areas is actually something which all the great scientists in history would really laugh at, and that is this idea that somehow being able to put together a formal structure of mathematical equations or any type set of formal rules like a computer program somehow is a substitute for actual knowledge. And this really became quite dominant in the second half of the 20th century, in the time in which the oligarchy was doing everything they could to destroy the Roosevelt legacy as a way of destroying the United States. They began to introduce into education and into science and so forth these types of methods, which they thought now could be implemented through because of advances in the digital computer, which took off with electronic switching mechanisms and microprocessors and so on and so forth. I always like to say that they had the illusion that with the advent of the digital computer, you could get very stupid people to be able to do very complicated things. And so the educational system for the last 20, 30 years has been geared towards keeping people stupid, but being able to enable stupid people to do complicated things. So I guess the first step in changing society is you have to get stupid people to realize that they're stupid.
Well, and part of the reason I asked you that was that I've been watching our next panelist, Will Modersky, with great interest over the last couple of years, because Will is someone who insists that things be proven to him, and is obviously undergoing a process of exposing the brainwashing in his own education. Will, when you look at the work with Kepler and compare it to what you were learning in science before you joined the LaRouche movement, I assume that you're struck by what Bruce just said, that there was actually an effort to make you and your whole generation incapable of doing anything but playing video games.
It certainly is the case. I oftentimes reflect on that when talking to students on campuses, is you get this same type of idea that Bruce is describing, that all you can really do is look at things, you can't understand why, can't understand the causes, and there really is within Kepler that has shifted basically. Throughout human history, up until the time of really Greek culture, you had these observations being taken. You had a knowledge of the motions of the celestial sphere around us, of in a certain sense of how things worked, but not necessarily why, of what their causes were. Until with the development of Plato, of some of the followers of himself and the Pythagoreans around him, did you really have the question finally asked of why are these things happening? What is the relationship to how the universe as a whole actually operates? And this, well, there's something of a stagnation between Kepler and perhaps the 1300s around Kuza and followers of himself such as Kepler and Leonardo da Vinci and so on, who actually applied those ideas. As Kepler does in this, actually applies it physically to science to actually figure out what that relationship is between what we're able to see and how the universe as a whole operates, which really with Kepler was a breakthrough, and now up through Leibniz, Gauss, Riemann, and LaRouche himself today, we're actually able to take into economics. And certainly none of this is being discussed on the campuses.
Well, from reading Kepler and doing the work that Jason described that you're doing with the new astronomy, when you go out and then look at the sky, the nighttime sky and the stars, you actually do see something beyond what you used to see just with your eyes.
Yeah, that's the fun part, is trying to conceptualize exactly what you are seeing. You go out at night and you look up, and it's kind of interesting to try to erase all the axioms and things you are taught in school of why things happen and what's actually happening, and just try to look at what you see, and then from that try to get at the cause. And as human beings developed, more and more precise means of measuring those motions, of measuring exactly what was going on. And that shift into, as I described earlier, that shift into from just describing it to the idea of applying that knowledge to act willfully to change those change our environment, know those universal principles, and use them to the betterment of mankind in general. That idea, having that idea when you're looking up into the space, up into the stars, certainly gives you a good gravity, a good heavy weight in your stomach of what Lynn's been developing of turning the Earthlings into Solarians, and making us think on a solar system level or even a galactic level, as he said even more recently.
Well, and recently, this was just a couple weeks ago at a cadre school up in Seattle, where Lynn raised this question of taking the solar system as a whole as your realm of activity, as opposed to being a mere Earthling. Bruce, I guess this does get back to the implications of forecasting, because on the one hand, Lynn has accurately forecast over the last 40 years a series of ratchet down processes of destruction of the physical economy, destruction of infrastructure, and now we're really at the end of the system. He's been talking about a systemic collapse and the need to have a fundamental transformation of our economic policies, including where we get our raw materials and how we create new raw materials. How does that flow from the work that you're doing with the Riemannian, the approach to Riemannian economics?
Well, what you have to do, first of all, on this question of forecasting, Lynn has always emphasized that he's not predicting, like some astrologer predicts things based on some fixed set of relationships. What Lynn is looking at is what are the physical principles that govern the universe and how do they interact? And these principles can be known and identified, and what you can forecast is the way in which certain decisions and certain actions by society, what the implications of those actions will be. You can't predict what human behavior is going to be, because it boils down to a willful question, whether or not human beings are going to willfully choose to what kind of decisions they actually make. Now, and that, of course, is obviously a very important and beautiful aspect of...
Because, Bruce, you need forecasting not merely to look at the folly of bad decisions, but to know where you're going to go or where you have to go.
Exactly. And that's the beautiful point, that the development of the human species depends on the creative powers of the mind, but the creative powers of the mind are purely willful. And so that means that what you're looking at with respect to the economy and future economic trends and economic developments is really a function of what is our intention for where we want to be 50 years from now. Now, if you look at the planet today and you look at the population of 6 billion and you look at the distribution of those people, largely in Asia, where the biggest concentrations are, you have concentrations elsewhere, and you look at the physical requirements to maintain that population of 6 billion and projecting into the future double or triple that, and you look at what those physical requirements are, not just to maintain people at some basic physical condition, some subsistence level, but at a level that affords access to every household on the planet of the basic material and cultural and educational, et cetera, conditions that are necessary to maximize the creative output of all 6 billion people. You see that given our current distribution of what are identified as raw materials in the on the globe, that it's insufficient. So therefore, we're going to have a complete redefinition of what we think of as raw materials and so forth, and also inventing new raw materials, which brings us into a whole new realm, which LaRouche has been emphasizing which is the idea of an isotope economy, not just looking at particular elements, but looking at the role of isotopes, both in abiotic and biological processes. So that means that you have to begin to think about how are we going to, for example, mine the oceans. If you take any cubic meter of seawater, you'll find lots of elements that we need, and minerals and so forth, that are necessary for the development of mankind. But they're in very diffuse amounts. And so, therefore, we have to develop new technologies to be able to do that. Now, that puts us into the direction of actually harnessing a lot more nuclear energy and other types of nuclear processes, such as fusion. So when you look into the future of mankind, you see us moving from primarily an economy based on chemical reactions to one based on nuclear processes involving nuclear fission and fusion, and also isotope fractionization and other such things. So these are all necessary if you have an intention that that there's going to be a future for the 6 billion people on the planet. If you're not thinking that way, then the only thing your intention is that there isn't going to be a future, and that's not a very good way to think.
So you're listening to The LaRouche Show. It is August 26, 2006. We're on with Bruce Director Jason Ross and Will Modersky, and we're discussing I would have to say we're discussing what is truly an epistemological revolution, both in the approach to economics and also society, what Lyndon LaRouche is doing with his most recent series of articles on economics, dynamics, and economy. Literally going back to the Vernadsky and de Richelieu's principle piece that he wrote back in June 2005. Now, Jason, looking at this process as a whole, you're, as we said earlier, part of the pioneer group. What's the idea? How are we going to expand this kind of scientific investigation throughout the LaRouche youth movement?
Well, LaRouche has given, he's pointed out the new astronomy as being the first thing to do. The next things that he wants are going to be Gauss's determination of the orbit of Ceres, Fermat's work on the least time principle of light. And what he stressed to us was that he wants to create a real understanding of dynamics. So developing an approach throughout the youth movement and then to develop into economic science of a conception of a truly dynamic nature of cause, or that there's a dynamic that underlying everything as opposed to mechanism. Now, I mean, one thing we can look at right now, for example, is the report that was released by the University of New York on the effects of the Big Mac program, which is something that LaRouche wants to be focused on, was that under Felix Roatan's control of New York City under the Municipal Assistance Corporation, cuts were made in healthcare, social services, a number of other things that caused, of course, an increase of death and illness from things such as tuberculosis, HIV, and homicide. Now, looking at that as a dynamic process is something that Lynn's put on the front burner for to be approached by the economics team and the LaRouche youth movement as an application of his economics to a specific question.
Well, and for listeners who want to get in on the at least the preliminary report on how the fascist Felix Roatan has a model for government, which is to destroy government, to kill the people. We do have the preliminary report on that in the same August 25th issue of the Executive Intelligence Review that has Lyndon LaRouche's article on dynamics and economy. So I would urge people to call into the LaRouche offices. We'll give that phone number again later in the show. So Jason, let me then just to go back to my question, what should people in the various LIM offices around the country be doing? I know here in Los Angeles and also in Houston, there's a group reading going on of the new astronomy. What else should people be looking at?
That's the thing to do, reading the new astronomy.
It's not something you can do overnight.
Well, it's something you can do in about 8 days, apparently, is the Boston plan, which they last week, Sunday and Monday, they spent all day reading, and they're going to do the same thing tomorrow and the next day with the idea of finishing the whole book in 4 days of reading of it, which is probably a good idea. I mean, getting through the thing quickly lets you have an idea of the whole at once. And one of the very important things about the animations that we're making is that it's going to dramatically speed up the time it takes to be able to get a decent, a thorough comprehension of what Kepler's doing in the book, which is a large book, and it's pretty complex if you're looking at it for the first time without any sort of assistance. But that's definitely the place to start.
I mean, the ironic thing is that it's such a central role that Kepler's discovery of universal gravitation is, and what Kepler says in the New Astronomy, and as the youth are finding out who working through it, that it's the only way you can really know how to do science, and yet it's not very widely read. There was not an English translation produced until the 1990s, and it's almost completely ignored. So almost you could probably say that 99.9% of every scientist in the United States today has not bothered to read through the New Astronomy, has no idea what Kepler did. And here we now have a large group of young people who are actually working through and mastering it. And I think that in itself is a major development and a major cause for optimism for the potential future for the human race.
And Will, I take it that you found this, this is something that I think many of the listeners would find interesting. You read this as a group, you work through the ideas together. Do you find this to be the most effective way to get the ideas as a social process?
Certainly. I know personally I probably would not have caught or would have given up early in the book. It's a 640-page book, so it's no light reading for sure. And the background knowledge, the rigor that it takes to actually go through it is purely a social process, and you need to bounce these ideas off people. You need to discuss, okay, well, what do you think he means by this? All right, well, how would you demonstrate this and really go through it? Although I must point out that it's more and more obvious the more I read of Kepler and the more I look at the New Astronomy, is he wants you to understand what he is writing. He does as much as possible to get the idea across in the most pedagogical, most well-demonstrated ways. Primarily, obviously, you have a whole chapter summary in the beginning where he goes through and says, look, this is my intention for the whole book, and very rigorously goes through throughout the book itself each idea that he's developing, and tons of geometrical ideas, but it definitely, in a group setting or in a Gaspard Monge style situation, it is most beneficial. One person gets it and they help the rest.
Mm-hmm. Now, Bruce, we do have an email from someone you know from down under in Australia, Christopher Emerson, who has a question about some, 189 workers in a high-quality industrial fastener company. They were shut down. There are up to 10,000 more workers in the machine tool sector facing a loss of jobs. And he says, is this what Lynn is talking about for September when he said the whole system could crash? I think a lot of people are still confused on how the forecast works. I know you mentioned before that it's not a prediction, but Lynn gave a forecast for September. From my standpoint, what he warned about is exactly what we're seeing unfold with the combination of strategic military crises, the breakdown of the government, and the continued accelerating collapse of the auto sector. How does this principle of forecasting, what does it mean to say that we're facing a systemic blowout of the system?
Well, I think it means just that. When you're talking about a systemic blowout, you're talking about everything is collapsing. Nothing works the way people think it's going to work. You could see that across the board. The problem is that you have a blowout. What you're seeing is a blowout of the financial system on the one hand. And the blowout of the financial system is simply because the financial system, going all the way back to what Lynn was talking about in the mid-1960s, decoupled from having anything to do with the real economy. And finances, when you have a situation like that, any time that's happened in human history where you have a disconnect between the financial system and the real economy, financial systems collapse. But financial systems collapsing is not the end of the world. Those things can come and go and be rebuilt and recreated. What you have going on now, which is what's really most dangerous, is you have a crisis in civilization itself, which Lynn has pointed out in a certain sense is largely centered on a generational problem with the baby boomer generation, the people who came into adulthood in the 60s and 70s, who became indoctrinated in a disease which really destroyed ancient Greece, which is the idea of sophistry. And this goes back to Kepler, that his adversaries, Ptolemy, Copernicus, Tycho Brahe, and their followers, all were sophists. They said, if there's a truth in the universe, there's no way you can know it. And so therefore, you have to operate from the standpoint that there is no truth. There's no universal principles. There's no consequences to what we do. Whoever has the power to assert the power is the power. And the ultimate extreme of this, of course, is fascism. But that's what you have happening now, which is that the baby boomer generation, which does not believe in truth, which cannot face reality, and which has basically been running the world for the last 20, 30 years, has brought the world to the brink of collapse. And the only thing that's going to turn this around is basically a shift back to reality. The only hope you have for that is you've got LaRouche, who comes from an older generation, which did believe in truth, and you have these young people coming up now who were also educated by boomers, so they don't have a belief in truth from their education, but they have a intention to believe in truth because they're looking at the world as the next 50 years is in front of them, and they're responding to what Lynn is saying. So the fact that you have this educational process, which I must say is not just happening in the United States, but is also occurring in Europe, in mm-hmm. Ibero-America, in Canada, you have chapters of the LaRouche Youth Movement who are all working on this question. That really is what you're looking at with the systemic crisis. The systemic crisis now is really a turn. We're seeing a collapse as a result of a turn away from truth towards sophistry, and now we're seeing the potential for a turn away from sophistry back to truth. And you're seeing what the youth are doing on the Kepler is really essential to that.
And a key moment of that will be the webcast. I want to get this out one more time for people. Wednesday, September 6th at 10 a.m. Eastern Time, Lyndon LaRouche will be live from Berlin, where he'll be addressing an audience. But the audience is really the whole world, including leaders from Eurasia, the Middle East, the United States, South America. Lyndon LaRouche's next webcast, September 6th at 10 a.m. in the morning. Bruce, we have very little time left, and I really wanted to get to this question of Riemannian tensors. Just give us a little bit of the headlines and the direction of what you did in this new pedagogical. We have less than 2 minutes, but go ahead.
Well, there's no way to fill you in 2 minutes, but I will refer you to an article that Lynn is coming out with, where he basically lays this out. I just got wind of it. It's being put to bed tonight. You have for the next issue of EIR. It's let's put it this way: that once people with the work that's happening in with the youth doing on the new astronomy with Kepler, you actually is just the first phase of a mastery of a large number of young people in the science of Riemannian economics and Riemannian physics, and that really is why you can say with confidence that there is some hope for the future.
Well, I know that there are people all over the country who have been reading with great interest, sometimes with great frustration, your ongoing series of Riemann for Anti-Dummies, and I think this is the basis for the transformation.
Well, as I said, you know, people, the oligarchy thought that they wanted stupid people to do complicated things, and we're saying, no, we don't want stupid people. This is for anti-dummies. Stupidity is overrated.
Overrated, but quite present.
That's right.
As we know as well, a certain degree of craziness as we see in the response to the Middle East and everything else. But it is the case that we have with the webcast the potential to present once again to people as time is running out a series of solutions, because hope actually comes from solutions. And I think the work that's being done by this pioneer task force is getting at that question of solutions and making it clear where they're going to come from. Jason and Will, thank you very much for joining us. Bruce, thank you. And we'll have you on again. This has been the LaRouche Show.